This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Play the play on the show.
Good morning. It's Tuesday. It's April 7th, and Major League Baseball is eyeing a return next month. It won't be like anything we've ever seen. It's still in the preliminary stages, and I would identify this very firmly as a test balloon, a trial balloon to see what's going on. But Jeff Passan of ESPN, who has been a friend of this station we've talked to quite frequently, said there are discussions to create, in essence, a virtual quarantine for players who will then congregate from the 30 Major League Baseball teams in Phoenix to play games there in front of no fans, with the idea that very vigilant testing will allow them to remain healthy and playing for us on TV. And quite honestly, it's the closest we've come to the idea that we might have sports back at any time soon here in this pandemic.
You could sell me on any proposal right now with just a little bit of a push. It feels like they've got a pretty solid plan together. There are certainly some real obstacles that they would have to get over. For example, there's 30 teams. There's 10 stadiums in Phoenix. That might be a little bit difficult. We're also talking about basically isolating, quarantining entire baseball teams. And if I'm a player, how do I feel about that over 4.5 months? How much is that bottom dollar worth? But from the sound of things and reading through this report by Jeff Passan, it feels like this has a lot of potential, Danny.
I would agree. I think there's a lot of things to flesh out. And let's start with the logistics of it, which is that under the proposal, which is being talked about between baseball and MLBPA, and nobody should think that this is the final detail or they're hammering it out. They're looking at the basic shape of it. You would have expanded rosters, and your players from your team would report to Arizona. You would have your coaching staff there, but probably a more stripped-down operation. Your major league operation would not be as big as it's been, but you're still looking at, I don't know, I would guess 20 to 25 support staff at the very least that are there, and everybody gets tested. And after they test negative for COVID-19, or maybe at that point they're even able to test for antibodies to see if the person has had it before and has fought off the infection, nobody goes in that is contagious. And you enter and you're essentially cleared to participate. At that point, you start living in relative isolation. It's not a biosphere. It's not where you enter one place where the only people that are allowed in are people who are completely clear. But you're living in a hotel, and you minimize any contact with the outside world. In fact, you're only traveling to go to the ballpark. There are 10 spring training facilities there in Arizona, in the greater Phoenix area. There's Chase Field, and then there's probably, and there's other facilities. And the one thing about playing in front of no fans is all of a sudden a lot of potential sites become suitable for Major League Baseball, if you're not talking about having to accommodate 30,000 fans. So that's the basic broad shape of it. How does that strike you? Because on the one hand, there's certainly resources that are being spent. You're also traveling people, which, as we're seeing, is one of the vectors, one of the ways to spread the disease. At the same time, you've got pretty rigorous testing in place, and this is all predicated on the idea that tests are available to the public, that we don't have the situation last month where NBA players are being tested and no one else, even people who are suspected to be sick, have tests available. That the tests are available, which I think is reasonable to expect a month and a half from now. And you test them, you get cleared, and then you basically create a safety zone in which players are presumed to be negative. They're still continuously tested. They're presumed to be negative so they can play games in front of us on TV.
It might be wishful thinking to assume, though, that all of a sudden we're going to have, Danny, the ability to test these players for COVID-19 with a quick turnaround. Really, this entire plan is entirely dependent on that. It needs to happen. I hope it happens, but I also hope if it happens, being a realist, that we put it in the appropriate places. I mean, this is something that we are giving to people that maybe are more at risk, who are potentially, you know, someone who could die from a disease like this if it escalates a little bit, as opposed to doing it for baseball. That is the thing that I think they're going to have to really establish. Like, hey, it's not just that we have the ability to test quickly. We also have this for everybody. This isn't just for baseball. This isn't just for basketball. Because it wouldn't look great if that's how it ends up going down. The teams, the organizations, the corporations involved in baseball and basketball have access to something that, honestly, the entire public probably needs a lot more.
I would agree with you entirely, Paul. Prerequisite number one is that the tests that are being used to clear players to play baseball can't create a strain or take away from testing that is necessary elsewhere. Baseball is a luxury. I think even the most dogmatic sports fan, such as ourselves, would say that we're dealing with a national outbreak in which the number of national casualties has surpassed 10,000. It's jaw-dropping. It's tragic. It's sad. Nothing that we do to bring sports back can get in the way of the ability to fight that disease and the spread of it. So the first thing is testing has to be so widespread that this is not a drain on it. The second part would be, would this actually be safe? And I think that the biggest trouble you would run into is, can you for 4 or 4.5 months or however long this would last that you're playing games at spring training sites in front of no fans, expect players to adhere to what is a quarantine? Or do you go, look, baseball players don't have curfews, at least none that I know of anymore. Football players do have curfews. Do you have a situation where there's a bed check at night in the hotels that they're staying at with police officers at the end saying, no, you can't go out? Because that's the other part, is that this only works if the players show the discipline to not go out and mingle with the public, because at that point, the person becomes a potential carrier, bringing it back in. You can not just contaminate the entire baseball apparatus, but you can continue the spread of the disease nationally.
And you're talking a lot of players. You're talking a lot of
like
people
1,000
that are
players,
involved
right?
with baseball teams. Right. So that's going to be really difficult because you'll likely have expanded rosters since all these games are taking place in Phoenix. There's an idea that since it gets so hot, you might not have guys playing 162 games over the course of a season.
Not only that, you have expanded rosters, which Jeff Passan talked about. And we're going to play the clip from him. You have expanded rosters because you have to anticipate that some guys might, in fact, end up getting sick. That you can't anticipate everybody remaining completely COVID-free even once they enter the relative isolation. Here is Jeff Passan.
Doesn't that
if someone gets sick at that point, what doctors and public health officials have told Major League Baseball and the players is that you do not necessarily have to shut down. If we have the testing, if we can contain this, if the entire room has not been infected, well, we're going to have much bigger rosters, and that is a big part of this whole plan.
He's out for 15 days due to COVID.
yeah,
it does. He's out 15 days due to COVID. Next man up.
Let's just throw as many bodies at it as we possibly can. I mean, it sounds like 1700s warfare. I thought we were past that. Now, look, there's a chance that things theoretically get better. I don't know how optimistic I feel about it. It varies for me day by day. I'm sure for a lot of you guys listening right now, it's the same exact thing. But I do think that some of the measures that they have in place to prevent possible spread in game are pretty smart. Electronic strike zone. No mound visits. 7-inning doubleheaders. Honestly, I would love 7-inning baseball games. I know that would maybe pick off some purists.
Baseball games are 9 innings.
Check that. 7-inning doubleheaders, though. So there might be doubleheaders.
Baseball games are 9 innings. I don't care if you played 2 in a row or not. We're not having baseball
light. You were correcting me for a second. Okay.
No.
I'm fine with it. Regular use of on-field microphones by players as an added bonus for TV viewers. I like that. I mean, we've seen that in practice before. It actually has worked out. And the awkward, hey, they're going to sit in the stands 6 feet apart. And that's going to stink. Like, imagine you're in the bullpen or you're a player, and all of a sudden you got to sit like 6 feet apart from the next person. Like, I'm pretty sure dugout conversations and especially bullpen conversations help pass the time because baseball can drag a little bit.
The other thing is, how would the players feel about that? And it's something that Passan talked about with Scott Van Pelt. And it's something for you to think about. You can text in your reaction to this, because that idea of would a player choose to do this. You're choosing to essentially leave your family or wherever you live to enter 4.5 yeah. months where you're not going to be around people.
I can't possibly see any player saying, yeah, sure, I'll go sequester myself in a biodome for 4.5 months to play baseball and I'll see my family. There's no way in hell I can see that. But just going back to your initial point and the possibility that maybe more likely.
I want to offer you an anecdote, actually.
Please.
Because, you know, I started hearing about this recently, and I wanted to run it by a couple of players. And I ran it by a player last night. And when I ran it by this player, he said exactly, I mean, almost word for word, Scott, what you said right there. And then this morning, he sent me a text, and he said, talked it over with my wife. She said, if it means getting paid, I can do the 4.5 months.
So there is that idea of being able to go back to work and that being, hey, it's not ideal for anybody. It's not going to be great, but we all make compromises. You can text into 710-710. We're going to have Chris Singleton that'll join us at 7:30 to continue this conversation.
In this entire situation, eventually money is going to talk. It stinks that that is the way that things go, but it is. And I think it will force some tough decisions. It's going to be tough for a lot of these players, and I'm sure for some of them, being away from their families for a really long period of time, extremely difficult. It's, I guess, going to be akin to being in jury duty during a very, very important trial, and you're just like basically isolated from everyone.
Or medical professionals right now, people mm-hmm. like in the
True.
Healthcare industry.
Yes.
Now, luckily, they will not be risking their lives, like trying to save the lives of other people that are dealing with the illness. So at the very least, baseball players would have that going for them. But yikes. It's an interesting proposal. And honestly, as maybe callous as it seems, I'm game for anything that gives us something back.
It's Danny and Gallant. It's time for What to Watch For.
What to Watch For, every morning at 7:10. Brought to you by Dubin Law Group. The first look at the stories worth watching today with Danny and Gallant.
First item on the docket, the NFL All-Decade team is out. We got some Seahawk representation. Earl mm-hmm. Thomas, not a surprise. Richard Sherman, not a surprise. Bobby Wagner, not a surprise. Marshawn Lynch, not really a surprise, though there's a chunk of this decade he didn't play in, but man, that dude was good. Pete Carroll, coach of the All-Decade team. Is this a make-good? I love the fact that Pete won it. It's just hard for me to look at his decade compared to Bill Belichick's decade and say, I guess Pete built it. So you give him credit in that regard, and Bill Belichick just sustained it with the greatest quarterback of all time? Should Pete have won it?
Well, it's two coaches that get it, so I understand why Pete gets it. Because who's after Belichick? Because it's been such a dominated decade by Bill Belichick. Who's second? I think you can make a case for Pete. I think you can make a case for Andy Reid, but it took him until this past year to finally win a Super Bowl. And also, maybe you put Sean Payton in there. Pete's been to multiple Super Bowls. I really think it's down to him and John Harbaugh as the other two coaches that could be up there. And since Pete's been to two Super Bowls, I feel like you got to give it to Pete.
Even though Harbaugh had the handicap of Joe Flacco? Like, does his count like 1.5 because he won it with Flacco?
John Harbaugh had playoff wins over some real bad quarterbacks like Chad Pennington, TJ Yates. I think when we look at what Harbaugh did, I think you could actually make some arguments in Pete's favor.
Paul's trying to win an internet argument here in What to Watch For. I really yep. appreciate the moxie.
100%.
What to Watch For.
Hey guys, what's going on with the NBA? Well, they say they won't reach a decision on what to do with the season until May at the very earliest. There's an ESPN.com report that the league is looking into a quick test for COVID-19 that would basically be like a diabetes test where you test your insulin levels and it would be available in minutes. Okay, but again, if this is available, can we please give it to the people that need to actually have it, like healthcare workers? Thank you.
The one thing that's different here is I think that the NBA is talking with a company about making the test. And that brings up a question of if you're a league and you're paying for something or supporting something to be developed so you can resume your league, it makes fiscal sense for you. Does it make sense on a national scale? And especially, I would say, in turn, look at what Bill Gates is doing, simultaneously developing 7 vaccines. knowing that a couple of those are going to be not cleared and obsolete, that he's basically wasting the money, but saying, hey, we need to be up and ready to mass produce and distribute this if and when it gets cleared.
What to watch for.
Are you ready for the virtual draft, Paul? The NFL has sent out a memo, a strongly worded letter to all its teams saying, nobody goes into team headquarters. There will be no sleepovers. You will not be getting together in the house of your general manager and be eating finger foods. This will be conducted entirely virtually. Of all the weird things that are going to happen in quarantine, the virtual draft is going to be the strangest.
I can't wait because I really want to see the teams that botch this. I think it would be very funny if the NFL added like extra little obstacles that teams had to get over. You could only communicate to one another in binary code. 1010111. I don't know.
No,
fun little wrinkles.
Honest question. If you can't have club personnel with you, that means no IT, right? Like you can't, if you're a codger of a coach, you can't have your team's IT person there with you. Like that's, you've got to have your grandchild. Like that's all the technical help you get.
The Bills GM said his IT person just became the most important person in his organization yesterday.
I'll bet he did. But that's the thing is that that guy's not supposed to be at your house, as I understand the virtual rules.
And Harbaugh is now saying that he is so worried about security with all of this. I mean, Zoom had a huge problem with security just like last week, and that's a big concern, like an actual concern for people.
Espionage.
I mean, part of me just wants to like be able to stumble into one of these Zooms and just act like, yeah, you know, Scooter McFellapants, man, he's an absolutely great prospect. I mean, we got to get this guy.
Let's bring in the professor to ask about exactly what the NFL is going to do in this unprecedented draft. It's our Morning Drive with John Clayton.
John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
It's a four-way battle, and there's only going to be three spots. Somebody has to go.
The first and final word on everything NFL from the professor, John Clayton.
Presented by DivorceLawyersForMen.com.
They scored 30 points a game. They're the best running team in football.
It's John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
Good morning, professor.
Good morning.
We've got five members of the Seattle Seahawks making the NFL's All-Decade Team. Head coach Pete Carroll, Richard Sherman, Earl Thomas, Marshawn Lynch, and Bobby Wagner. Of all of those players who made it, and coach, who do you think was most deserving?
I think that, you have to kind of look at maybe Richard Sherman, because I can't, you know, guys in the secondary, I think, you know, get the biggest nod. You know, I'm sure Cam Chancellor finished like second team, probably in the number three or number four hole, or number, you know, probably the fourth safety, but he didn't get in. But I think when you're looking at Thomas, you're looking at Sherman, you're looking at Wagner. I mean, that's the bulk of what helped get this team there. Then of course, that Russell Wilson probably finished third or fourth, so he was on the door knocking in. But the interesting part about this list, and of course, you know, it was fun to vote on it because it was such a big long thing. We had like about 120 guys to start off and vote for because we had to go like, you know, four quarterbacks in the first team, four quarterbacks in the second team, is that, you know, you go through it and it's just fun to be able to, you know, put guys in perspective and where it's going to go. But, you know, what's also great about this is that, you know, the guys on the All-Decade Team all have great chances to go into the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
John? How is the NFL going to enforce this virtual draft? Because they've said you can't congregate at anybody's house. Does that mean, like, hey, the GM's house, it's just got to be him? Because it seems like that's going to be tough to decide, are there other people in the presence at that house?
Well, I think the IT person is allowed to be there. So I think that, because again, if something goes wrong, then you can fix it up. So that, I think, is going to be the one exception. And because again, that was all in the memo. But no, it's like, I think the big thing is what they don't want to have is like three or four people from the front office all together with the GM, you know, helping him out, because again, that's, you know, violates what they're looking for. It gives them an unfair advantage. And so how are they going to enforce it? I mean, it's going to be pretty tough. I mean, because, you know, you're not going to have anybody there to enforce it. I mean, because again, if you try to enforce it and you have somebody there, then that's a violation too, because, you know, nobody from the league can do it. So, you know, I'm sure there's probably some ways that you can cheat and do all those different things. You just can't get caught.
There are some real logistical concerns for a lot of these teams, because especially for players that come out of schools that are smaller, that maybe don't go to the NFL Combine, finding that diamond in the rough is going to be really difficult. With the lack of information out there, John, do you think that it might be more likely to see a lot of trade ups in this year's draft because teams want to get guys that they feel like are sure things as opposed to maybe sitting back and taking extreme Hail Marys on a prospect they might not have any information on.
It could be, but I think it's also going to be very difficult to be able to get those trade-ups because thinking about the communication problem that's going to be there. You know, because, you know, you have 15 minutes in the first round, you got, 10 minutes and then 5 minutes, and when you start getting that five-minute thing, I mean, do you even have enough chance to be able to call somebody and get them on the phone and make some kind of a trade? I mean, certainly you can do it, but I think it's going to be more difficult to do.
That question of how draft will be valued, here's my biggest question is, are there going to be players that teams get set on because they zeroed in on them early in the process? And either other teams didn't have a chance to catch up and figure out, oh, this guy's good. I think you might see more teams that get smitten with somebody and decide like, oh, nobody's on to this guy. We're going to trade up and get him. I think there's going to be a lot more activity one way or the other, whether it's teams trading down or teams trading up. I think we're going to see a lot of deals.
We could, but again, that's like doing the theory, but how about the execution? Because remember, it's like, okay, you know, because it would be nicer if they extend the period of time so you can actually make a few phone calls. But I don't know if they're going to do that because, you know, again, you know, what happens if the line's busy of what you're calling? I mean, you know, it's not like, I mean, I'm sure you're going to be calling on a cell phone. If that line's busy, can you be able to do it? Because once you run out of time, you run out of time.
John, I want chaos. I want absolute chaos. What's the best memory we have of the draft? That one year where the Vikings didn't get their pick on time and all of a sudden other picks are getting rammed up there to the podium. I'm rooting for absolute chaos.
Yeah, I'm not. It's like terrible? We have enough chaos in our lives right now. It's like we want chaos in the draft. Let's not add to the chaos of what's going on. Let's stay away from that one.
Well, chaos is a ladder, John. Come on. That's how you get up to the top. That's what Littlefinger would say. So the Buccaneers, they nicknamed their pursuit of Tom Brady Operation Shoeless Joe Jackson. John, how would you grade said nickname?
B minus, because you're trying. I mean, I know that Tom Brady's old, but I don't think he. I mean, I don't think he goes back into the 1918 type of era, 1917 type of era. So I think I know he's old, but not that old.
Here's the backstory. Bucks director of player personnel, John Spytek. He loves Field of Dreams. He played with Tom Brady for a year in Michigan, and apparently the idea of Brady joining the Bucks was to him as likely as Joe Jackson walking out of a cornfield, and I guess he just annoyed Jason Light constantly saying, if we build it, he will come, go the distance. So that's how Tom Brady became a Tampa Bay Buccaneer, because there was an annoying person in the player personnel department who was obsessed with Field of Dreams.
So I should probably change it to a C-plus or a C-minus then.
Oh, really?
Good.
That made
good.
Me like
Thank
it
you.
More, John. You liked it less because of that?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, yeah, I love Field absolutely. Of Dreams. It's one of the great sports movies ever. But it's like you're in football and you're pursuing a football player with a baseball analogy.
Oh, fantastic. I love the professor downgrading it for mixing your sports metaphors. John, we love you, man. You're the voice of reason to us in the mornings. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay, thanks.
That is the professor, John Clayton, and do not mix your sports metaphors around him. Hear him 10 to noon on the John Clayton Show. Coming up next, we're going to talk to Chris Singleton. He's a baseball analyst for ESPN, and we're going to speak specifically about this idea that we might see some baseball without fans in Arizona in May. That's ahead.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
It is Danny and Gallant. We're going to have the first round of our Mad Madness. The rant tournament starts at 8:15. But this morning, we got some news or reports about the possibility of baseball returning to the field in May at spring training sites. And we're joined now by Chris Singleton, who is a Major League Baseball analyst for ESPN. And Chris, first of all, we're really grateful for you joining us. We thank you for taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure. Good morning to you guys.
Yeah, it's such a weird time. This should be one of the best times of the year where we're starting baseball and it's just getting underway and instead we're kind of all cooped up wondering what's going to happen. And I'll admit, I was intrigued when I saw this morning the possibility or the idea that baseball might be back on the field at spring training sites without fans, maybe as soon as May. How did that idea, just the general idea of that, strike you?
Very interesting. There's a lot, like with any path back to, baseball, here in the you know, short term is going to be very, very interesting with all of the different layers and all of the different. It's just never as simple as, okay, we'll play the games here. I mean, when they're talking about the details of everything, essentially being, you know, isolated, you know, sort of sequestered from their families, from, I mean, you can go to the ballparks, no fans there. I think I read something where, you know, maybe the players sit, you know, instead of the dugout 6 feet away in the stands. I mean, it's just, I feel like just throwing stuff against the wall. And don't get me wrong, I'm very open and welcome to hear anything, any kind of ideas to get the game back going. But you just, you know, you hear some of these things and, you know, it just sounds like you're throwing stuff against the wall, see if it'll stick. I don't know how you, if you're going to put, you know, players and everything like that in that close quarters, you know, how does it not speak to the rest of society in terms of, hey, you guys can sort of congregate or be in these, you know, quarters the same. So it's just really, to me, like you said, it's a very uncertain time. The world is, has changed and it is changing. And, you know, the new normal that we're headed towards, it remains to be explained or understood.
If you were still playing and this was proposed to you, where you would basically be sequestered at a local hotel with other players, coaching staffs, and other essential personnel for possibly up to 4.5 months, how would you feel about that? Would you be willing to do it?
I think I would. I think, you know, when you... There's a difference between, you know, my friends used to joke when I was playing off-season Chris and in-season Chris. And off-season Chris, laid back, fun, joke, had a lot of, you know, good times. But season Chris was focused, dialed in to the job every day and, you know, the intensity level. So I think when you talk about players and their ability to really focus in on their craft and discipline themselves and separate themselves from the rest of society, if you will, to chase a goal, chase a dream, these guys are wired for it. I was one of them. So I think that as unsettling as that could be to be away from your family for that amount of time, I guess the positive as well is that it's not – like, let's just say, for example, they said, okay, we're going to get you guys out here in May. We're going to start the season June 1st. We're anticipating you're going to be away from your families for 4.5 months. But if things turn in July or August and we get a grip on whatever's going on and everybody can return to normal, then you get so it's not like it's set in stone that you're going to be away from your family. So I think even more so, that you could go into it saying, hey, it could be 4.5 months or whatever. It could be a month and a half. One way or the other, I need to get back to work. That's going to help keep, you know, as a player, it's going to help you keep you sane. You're used to being away from your family, at least for extended periods of time. And you just roll with it. And on top of it, you know, guys, they want to make their money. Even though they're making a lot of money, it's all relative to the lifestyle and the bills and the things that they have. So I think without question, especially for some players, there's a lot of money that's on the table for them.
We're talking to Chris Singleton. He's an ESPN Major League Baseball analyst, and ESPN is presenting its encore coverage. Tonight, they're re-showing the game where Cal Ripken Jr. set the consecutive games played streak where he broke Lou Gehrig's mark. That was back September 6, 1995. That game's going to be shown tonight. It's 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern on ESPN, the Angels taking on the Orioles. Chris, I'll ask you a different question. The idea of playing not in front of fans, that would have to be absolutely surreal for a professional athlete. And it's just got to change what it would feel. Could you imagine what that would feel like?
Yeah, it would be because you know that adrenaline that you get from the fans. Let's just say I'll take you a little bit inside. Let's say the day of a player, you're out, you're taking batting practice. The gates haven't opened yet. All of a sudden, the gates open. People start flooding in. You get people in the outfield, on the sides, they're, you know, wanting autographs. They're yelling at you different things. Hey, we love you, whatever, right? So you start to get that buzz. Then you go in the clubhouse. You chill out, eat some dinner, do whatever you need to do. You get some time off before the game starts. And one thing for me that was so cool, and when you talk about the appreciation of, like, fans and them being there and the energy that they bring is, let's say the game, 7:05 game, I leave the clubhouse at 6:45, and I'm going out down the right field line or the left field line to start doing my pregame running, stretching, whatever. Man, popping out of that dugout, running down the side of that warning track to that foul line, and the fans that are lined up there, the fans that are cheering for you or yelling for you, man, that's a it's a small thing, but it's a big part of, like, just setting the tone for the night or the day that you're in, the game that you're about to embark on. And that's just, you know, before the action's even started. So now you start the game and, you know, you got your fans behind you. You got at times they're against you, just all of those things. Yeah, it would be definitely different. So I would imagine that we would see probably more unity, more camaraderie between opponents playing now to try to create some sense of fun, entertainment. And so something that you wouldn't see normally where, let's say, the other side's, you know, saying something to the other team, you know, it's those are kind of things that clear the benches, right? I think in this instance, this potential or hypothetical situation, that it would lead to more banter back and forth without this sort of offense type of thing and retaliation type of thing. I think it would just create some banter that guys would need to at least sort of be a little bit of a distraction from, you know, the tasks, because you as focused as you are, those things that are out there, the noise, the fans yelling at you, this, that, and another, those are good little distractions that just kind of allow your subconscious mind and everything that you've trained yourself to just flow and perform. Kind of takes your conscious mind sort of out of it, because, you know, when you overthink things, that's when you're not good. So it'd be interesting to me to see just how those things like that would develop between the players and between opponents.
Some of the possible changes to the game would include potentially an electronic strike zone, which would allow the plate umpire to maintain distance between the catcher and batter. No mound visits from the catcher or pitching coach. We might have 7-inning doubleheaders on field microphones, which I think would be fantastic. But specifically those first two, the electronic strike zone and no mound visits, how do you think that would affect the game?
Well, they've been talking for a while about the electronic strike zones and wanting to, you know, get that going. I think, you know, this kind of creates a real good opportunity for them to test it if they're going to do it or not. My thing is, if you're going to put the batter in the batter's box and you put the catcher behind the plate, you know, what's the deal of having the umpire back there as well? I mean, I think that, you know, things are being thrown out, and it's, nobody knows exactly, you know, what's the risk, what's the exposure. And then on top of it, if you're going to allow all of these people that are going to be together and they're supposed to be in an isolation or whatever it is, then what does it matter? You know, what does it matter if the umpire is behind the catcher? I mean, so my thing again, what is it? You know, what are we determining? I don't see that there's any absolute determination that they understand. Now with the mound visits, I think that's going to be tough. I mean, this is going to be so different. You're going to have guys that have, you know, in an express fashion, have gotten themselves, you know, back on the field and ready to play, and you don't have a mound visit. What's the point? Guys cover their faces anyway. They got more than masks. They got leather in front of their faces when they're talking to each other. You know, when a catcher goes out there or a pitching coach goes out there, I mean, they're masked men anyway. So I think that'd probably be a safer encounter than some of the other ones.
See, Chris, you're ruining my fantasy, because what I imagined is that the guy would go out to the mound, stay 6 feet away, and then you'd hear the manager. What I've always imagined what they say to the pitcher is, throw strikes! Because that's what I just assume 95% of all mound visits are. But you're very right. Chris, I'm really grateful for you taking the time. It's been, when we've welcomed people on, I always feel this now, asking how are you? It kind of has a little extra urgency or a little more meaning in it. I sincerely, and all of us here, hope that you and all your loved ones are doing really well, and we're grateful for you spending the time with us today.
Yeah, likewise. My pleasure being with you guys and back at you. And, you know, it's times like these that we really realize how connected we are and how much, you know, we need each other and depend on each other and how we should be there for each other. So, you know, you guys do a great job with what you do in covering sports. And, you know, it's part of this whole network here. And I think times like this, you know, we got to look out for each other. And so it's, you know, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That is Chris Singleton, and we'll look forward to catching up to him. We got some games to talk about, but really nice to chat with him. That question of how baseball returns, is this the biggest decision players will make, or is it up to the league? We'll talk about all the ramifications. That's coming up next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
This might be a bit of a buzzkill coming in the wake of that Jeff Passan report that we talked about, and we talked about further with Chris Singleton. Baseball released a statement saying Major League Baseball has been actively considering numerous contingency plans that would allow play to commence once the public health situation has improved to the point that it is safe to do. Blah, 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 blah. In a nutshell, they basically said, we have not made any concrete decisions on coming back. Basically taking a little bit of the wind out of the sails of that Jeff Passan report, Danny, that quite honestly had me feeling pretty good this morning.
Well, I don't think that's out of the question. And I think one of the things that you're going to see sports leagues do is that they have to make plans that are almost contingencies. Like, hey, we're going to look at the possibility of doing this. Because if you make a decision to do something 7 weeks down the road, you can't decide it 6 weeks down the road. Like, you have to start laying the groundwork. Yes. And I don't think anybody should freak out and say, oh, baseball is unfeeling and how could they do this when given the current situation? Well, baseball's looking at doing this based on the idea of where things will be in 6 to 7 months. So give them a little bit of latitude until they announce, hey, this is what we're doing. Don't say that they are it's criminal or they're uncaring about people. They're looking at it and saying there is some evidence out there. Look, I live in New York City, and all of the indicators are that it's a huge crisis right now. There are actually some positive signs right now that this we may be nearing a peak, that some of the new cases have declined. There's some evidence out there that would lead you to believe that 2 weeks from now, the situation here might not be as bad as it is now. And if you're a business, and baseball is a business, and you look at it and say, okay, if things are getting better 7 weeks from now, what's the scenario where we could return? I actually think that the plan that Passan outlined, it's not unreasonable. I think there are some sacrifices, and that doesn't mean that I think it's 100% great. But the idea of, okay, we get teams, have them assemble a roster of, say, 30, 35 players. We test them. We make sure that everyone is negative for COVID-19 or has antibodies in their body showing that they've previously fought off an infection if they didn't know they had it, that they're safe. They're not contagious. They're not going to be carriers of the disease at this time. And you put them in a relative quarantine and you start playing games without, if you could create sort of a virtual bubble where they're only interacting with other people who are negative, you could create a situation where it's safe to play baseball. Is that worth exploring? Sure. It doesn't mean you should definitely do it and that full steam ahead for a restart on May 17th, but there's nothing wrong with exploring that idea. And I also think it's interesting to ask some of the questions, because maybe by having a critical analysis of this, you can point out why this should or should not be done. And I think the first question that we both said is that the testing for Major League Baseball, the prerequisite would be that those tests have to be readily available to anyone who needs them before we start using them to test baseball players so that we can resume playing baseball. Any sort of national crunch, like there has to be an abundance of supply before we can do something like a luxury of sports. So I think those are good things to take steps so we don't get to the point where a decision's made and then they're like, okay, you guys look like idiots because you didn't really vet this.
this idea that anyone looks callous right now, too, when they are thinking about measures about a return to normalcy, I've got to say, are just flat out wrong. Because here's the thing. We don't have anything else to do right now outside of think about what's next. And here's the other unfortunate elephant in the room. Yeah, this is a human crisis right now, but we are attached to money, sadly. And money is a problem. And baseball is going to look at this and say, well, I mean, shoot, what are we going to be out this year? Billions of dollars, potentially, without having a season, without ticket gates? I think $10 billion in revenue every single year. They're thinking about ways that they can make money for their employees, which obviously at the top of the food chain are the baseball players. But as you go further and further down, there are people that are working in these organizations that don't make a whole lot of money. This is the question that a lot of corporations and a lot of people, employers, are going to have to ask themselves. Like, how do we get people back out there? Because we are not in a great situation as far as the economy is going, at least of late. So these are things that need to be addressed clearly along the way. But I don't think the idea of all of a sudden putting out a proposal, which, again, is just a proposal at this point in time. Baseball made clear of that with that statement that they just put out. There's nothing wrong with it. Things need to be fleshed out, and I think some of them are going to be really difficult questions. For example, Danny, and I think this is the most difficult one, if you're a player, would you be willing to essentially voluntarily go into a quarantine? Because that is essentially, per this proposal, what baseball players would have to do, and that could last 4.5 months.
I think that has to be the decision of the player. I'd be disappointed in any players union that forced that on players, that like, hey, you don't have an option. I would think that the player should have the ability to choose whether or not they want to work, because that's a fundamentally different job. And I think as we talk about all of the decisions about when you go to work or when you don't, construction workers, many of whom are still working, and some of that construction work isn't on what you would call essential. I read a Facebook post from somebody who was talking about he poured a pool deck for someone, and he was grateful to have the work. He's also worried about potentially contracting COVID and passing it along to his wife. Everybody's making these sort of balanced decisions, and I think that all workers should have the ability to choose whether or not they want to be at work. I also realize I'm in an area of incredible privilege there, that I am able to currently continue Same. Working at my job from home, and that most people and many people don't have that privilege. But I think that a worker should have the ability to choose whether or not they're going to subject themselves to this, to increased danger of a contagious disease in order to continue with their profession. I do think that that is a question. The other one is the public health element of it. You are going to be bringing large crowds of people together, even if you have no fans. It's two Yep. teams full of players. It's two teams and their support staffs. You're going to have people moving inside and not following stay-at-home orders. Can you maintain enough distance that it's not dangerous? Or if there is an outbreak, can you sufficiently contain it so it doesn't lead to other outbreaks? Like, there's a lot of different things that need to be answered and fleshed out. Personal choices, are the players obligated to work? Sort of society-wide, is this a threat to public health? And how can that threat be best minimized or balanced? And then the other part is, but look, we're businesses. I read that a quarter of the American economy is idled, like a quarter. All of those sectors of the economy are looking at, hey, how are ways, what are conceivable paths for us to return and operate safely Exactly. while getting back on our feet? Because that's real world issues that are affecting people and millions of people out there.
Right. And these are things that they need to do. So the question I have for those of you listening right now, it's a challenge more so. Put yourself in the shoes of these players. Would you be willing to go back? Would you be willing to basically voluntarily, and yeah, you're getting paid for it, but voluntarily put yourself in isolation, away from your family for potentially 4 or 5, who knows how long this thing lasts, months. It is Danny and Gallant. He is Danny O'Neill. I am Paul Gallant right here on 710 ESPN Seattle. Up next, we've got Brock Heward in the house for Blue 42 with 5 Seahawks on the NFL's All-Decade team. What does he think about all the decisions that were made yesterday? You'll find out next.